Hello humans and welcome to Audio Face, an irreverent podcast about the music news and music culture that actually matters. I am Dan. Sean is not here. He is currently on a little bit of a vacation, hoping the best for him on his vacation, well deserved. But in the meantime, I have a bonus episode for you. I'm going to be talking a little bit about the history, the back history of Muse, because their new album Simulation Theory drops today when we're dropping this podcast, and Sean and I will be reviewing that when he gets back from vacation on the other side of this weekend. So. We're going to be talking about that along with Lil Peep's new album and whatever else we kind of crop up and find. I don't know, it's Friday morning, so I still need to kind of look out there and figure out what's where they're reviewing and what's not, because that's how the process goes. Anyways, it is going to be fun to go into Muse. They used to be one of my top favorite bands, and I guess used to be is kind of giving away a little bit of suspense, but I'm going to go through all of their albums and kind of their history first so you kind of get an idea. We do this for a lot of artists who have a long history, or at least a long enough musical history, going back a couple years, at least a decade or so, so that when they release new albums, you kind of know their backstory going into it. And it helps a lot for when you listen to the Audio Face review that'll be in the next episode. Anyways, so Muse is a band. They started in Teignmouth, Devon, a little part of England, in 1994. They originally, they went through a lot of different names. I think the closest name they had was Rocket Baby Dolls right before Muse. And they were like this post-punk, rock, like goth kind of interesting sort of group. They want to battle the bands, which they didn't actually expect to. And then they decided to take being musicians seriously. Because I guess they kind of just did it as a parody, but they turned out to be very, very good. So they continued on that. Their first album, the first proper release, was called Showbiz, and that was a very interesting sort of first work. I don't remember much of it personally because my entry into Muse was shortly after, but I did listen to this a little bit. You can see the beginnings of what Muse is going for. It's very kind of operatic. It's using a lot of tendencies and elements of music that are kind of popular in orchestral music or classical music, but in a way that was really kind of steeped in a late 90s alternative sound, because Showbiz debuted in 1999. It's 13 songs, 54 minutes long, a proper album size, and yeah, it was a nice first going out effort, but I want to get to when I really started to get into Muse, and I think when Sean did too. It sucks that Sean's not here to do this episode with me, because I know he and I can go back on Muse. When we were first actually becoming friends, I think Muse was one of the things we bonded on, because he introduced me more to Radiohead, and I kind of introduced him into Deep State Gorillaz, like more Gorillaz than most people kind of know from the surface. But Muse was something we kind of both came to together back in like what, sixth or seventh grade, when Sean and I became friends, and we both kind of knew this coming in and really liked this music. And I think the first Muse album I really, really liked was Origin of Symmetry. I heard a couple of songs in this, Space Dementia, I remember, for being this kind of soft but weird, again, kind of carrying that operatic vibe. And then Dark Shines, it's a 10th song on the album. It's really deep into it. It captures what I think love about most classic Muse. It's a rock song if you're really just kind of thinking about it as, oh, there's a guy playing guitar and it's loud and there's a guy kind of screaming and there's drums and it all sounds kind of rocky. But then you look at the composition of the piece, it goes a lot more. It has the same ups and downs and crescendos, and it has the same layout that a more complex classical or orchestral composition would actually have. And it does that all in a rock song in under 5 minutes. Muse songs tend to be like above average in length, usually 3.5 to 5 minutes. And it's not unusual for a Muse song to hit the like 5 or 6 minute mark, just because these really are these like rock orchestral pieces. It's a really amazing thing they can kind of put together. And Origin of Symmetry is kind of where you get to see Muse's aesthetic, whereas before they kind of went into, I guess they described themselves as gothy and almost satirical in how much they went up to that, like goth glam, I believe what they called. Muse's later aesthetic and view was sort of this dystopian, what is it like in the end of the world? What are the complex emotions and spiritual, like, kind of the ideas that you come across when you have a, when you're living in a society that's kind of crumbling around you and you're trying to make sense of that, but also express the emotions that come as a result of that. I know I'm trying, like, it sounds like I'm trying to make some larger political point here. And Origin of Symmetry was released in 2001. I'm not sure which bit of 2001 was of that. And even then, I'm not sure if it had a lot of relationship to politics happening at that time, like 9/11 or whatever. But it's an aesthetic, musically and artistically and lyrically, that is something I really liked about early Muse and continues through their kind of what they're making right now. In between, or right after Origin of Symmetry, they released an album called Hullabaloo, which it's a soundtrack to something, and I'm not like completely remembering what it is off the top of my head. Oh, they released a like live video album, live at Zenith in Paris, which was like just their live albums, I guess. So live songs they had made up till that point. So nothing too, not uninteresting there, but you know, live albums, it's not really new music, so it's harder to kind of go into. Absolution is the Muse album where I started liking even more Muse. It's a lot more, I guess, tense and faster paced than I think earlier Muse albums were, and I think it's a peak, well, yeah, I think it's one of the peaks of how like fast paced and almost metal and, I don't want to say screamo, but like hard rock kind of influence they are. Stockholm Syndrome, the fifth song on the album, is another one of my like favorites, I think really gets that point across. As well as Butterflies and Hurricanes, another song that really kind of matches, it really captures Muse's spirit of being, I hate overusing the phrase, but operatic and at the same time rocky and full of the kind of fun you would get from alternative rock. And so they had kind of created their own sound at this point, and we're talking about 2004 with Absolution, but it was distinct and it was fresh and it was definitely recognizable. Absolution, I don't remember, I'm not honestly thinking about tracks. I'm not thinking about tracking the billboards when I'm in the charts when I'm thinking about Muse albums, because Muse is such a personal experience for me that was very insulated from the idea of, oh, is this charting? Is it doing well? I kind of just discovered it the same way you discovered music at the time, which was honestly Pandora. Or at least a couple years later, honestly, Pandora, and just using that to discover the sounds of new music, and that was really cool. It was received critically well, but, and Absolution was Muse's first album to chart in the United States, actually, which really lays down the framework for what I think is probably, like, peak Muse. I wouldn't say peak Muse, because I think they've made things that are better than this, but this is, like, when Muse really kind of rode the wave and became a... I don't mean that in a bad way, but they rode the wave and became a staple of mid-2000s alternative rock. Like, I think of this era in music history forever, not just by Muse bias, but Muse is one of these staples of alternative rock for this, like, early aughts, as it's being called now, era. And they did that largely with Black Holes and Revelations. This would have been their fourth studio album. It was released in 2006. With songs recorded in 2005-ish, mostly. And this just had, like, banger after banger after banger, as far as bangers are referred to in rock. Supermassive Black Hole, Starlight, Exopolitics, Knights of Sidonia. These are all really, really, like, popular songs that got released and got really, like, major critical acclaim. The album cover is very striking, too. It's just the four Muse fellows, and they look like they're just on Mars sitting at a table. And it matches this in-the-middle-of-nowhere, eerie, post-apocalyptic sort of thing that Muse has been going for ever since their early days. And you really kind of see it come out as they kind of wanted to intend it here and in a few other albums from there. I think... in Black Holes and Revelations, they keep the elements of what made their music really operatic, with the lead singer's kind of, I don't want to have wailing have a bad connotation, but is wailing, continuing, like, singing, holding notes, and really, like, high keys. He's a very talented singer. But he's holding all of those notes while they're, as far as the other instruments are going, just kind of keeping it to a typical alternative rock kind of style. But typical alternative in rock is a very, like, hard explanation to have. And so what you're really kind of getting at there is this really weird mix of alternative, where in a lot of orchestral music, you're really kind of bringing elements and instruments together to make this beautiful, like, wall of sound, I guess, surrounding you, right? Whereas in, they'll do the same thing, Muse will do the same thing, but they'll take away certain elements of songs to almost make them poppier, make them a little bit more simpler, or to just emphasize a certain moment or an element. Like, either you want to emphasize the bass line, or you want to emphasize the voice. Like, they took little bits of things here and there, and so that kind of just really pieced the album together and made it really good. I keep forgetting his name. Matt Bellamy is the singer of Muse, and so this is why I'm deferring to. His voice is really kind of amazing. He can kind of scream things and yell things in this way that kind of Thom Yorke can, where it has a lot of passion and energy. Nevertheless, it's still rather apparent at how, you know, soulful it is. It's not like a screaming for no apparent reason, or it's a screaming that doesn't really have much of a sense to it. Believe it or not, I think it gets better. And I think when I meant peak Muse, I think this might be peak Muse what I'm talking about. I'm of course talking about The Resistance, their 2009 album. It was 11 songs long, 54 minutes, very, very optimistic. The first half of it is kind of a typical Muse release, what you could say. And then it goes into a more literally orchestral, and by orchestral I mean there's a three-part song, Exogenesis, that if taken apart would be easily 12, 13 minutes long. That's just this symphonic rock, just amalgamation that's beautiful on its own, but we need to talk about those first three songs. Uprising, Resistance, and Undisclosed Desires. Muse released those three songs from The Resistance, their 2009 album, and they were everywhere. You could not go anywhere without hearing the songs. If you've heard one Muse song, I guarantee it's either The Resistance or Uprising, because they're overplayed a lot through the early 10s. That they will not force us, like that kind of little beat. It's always lovely when I start to sing parts of songs. But The Resistance was just like a wonder thing. Wolstenholme, who is the backing vocals, who also, shout out to him, because the backing vocals really kind of bring together Muse. It's not just a lead vocals kind of effort. The backing vocals really add a lot of depth to the album and to the work, since it's incredibly important. I also love that The Resistance is loosely based on the 1984. I'm so used to Sean's the 1979, but Muse had always had this kind of distrustful of government and, you know, higher power kind of thing to it. You know, when you're dealing with post-apocalypse and kind of the themes that Muse has always been kind of dealing with for their whole musical existence. It's had to do with post-apocalyptic scenes and scenes of emptiness, where you're picking up the pieces from a society in ruins, and a society gets in ruins because of politics. A society's body politic ends up being messed up and misconstrued. And so it's kind of a natural step for Muse to go a little more political in certain things. And so The Resistance is kind of the first, like, balls-to-the-wall foray into that. They did political songs before, of course, don't get me wrong, but The Resistance is very, very obvious things. I mean, Uprising is the first song on the album, and it wins that first song of the album, Wow, You Amaze Me Award, because it's really amazing. But that became the battle anthem for protest movements and marches kind of all over the world. Like, they will not control us, they won't stop degrading us, we will be victorious. Like, all of these lyrics, it's just perfect for the song Uprising. So they made an absolutely perfect song there. Resistance matches their, like the song, title track Resistance, which is the second song on the album, which is a very bold move. It truly captures the Muse sound kind of all into one song. I think Resistance, the song, is peak Muse because it captures the rock, it makes it operatic, it has choir elements, it just makes rock into this. Muse kind of elevates rock in this album. It's really hard for me in like talking so highly of it, and it's amazing. I didn't think I'd like a Muse album more than Supermassive Black Hole, but The Resistance, when it came out, was amazing. It's not my favorite Muse album, only because, I mean, here are a couple reasons. These are really my being a super picky music connoisseur reasons. The album is very top heavy, so the first couple songs are meant to be the more like mainstream single songs, and that's great. And then the latter half, they focused way more into the concept, and they just went all in into the concept. And so they released an album. It has the hits that are supposed to do well for the record label and justify the band's existence financially. It does the artistic stuff, but it's kind of just plopped together. And as an album, it doesn't make a super ton of sense just as a playthrough, but it still makes a good amount of sense. And yeah, it just seemed very top heavy. Uprising, Resistance, Undisclosed Desires, and even United States of Eurasia to some extent are such really powerful songs that they could have been interspersed a little bit. And then Guiding Light, Unnatural Selection, MK Ultra, just later in the album, right before you get to the super exogenesis orchestral part, they're just really forgettable. And I feel like you didn't have to, it's like they checklisted this album and forgot to sort. So they checked everything that needed to be on the album for all the stakeholders to be happy, but it just, they didn't really do any organizing or think of how can we arrange this in a more thoughtful way. But nevertheless, it's a phenomenal album. They went on a tour and a half with it. Also, just a little bit of inside baseball. The band was about to break up during the Resistance. Wolstenholme, which I was kind of saying earlier, the backup singer, also does bass guitar. He was going through a serious bout of alcoholism, and that was kind of threatening to break the band apart. I didn't really read too much into that, as in, like, I didn't read a lot of information, so I can't just parrot it to you right now, but of course, a lot of folks have dealt with alcoholism in their lives, or have dealt with alcoholics, and you can know the impact that can have either for oneself and how one's outlook on life is, to how one deals with other people. And that can be in a very adversarial way, especially when you're in a band and you're in that environment where you have to criticize each other a lot, but also be nice to each other. And it's very hard to deal with that in a band setting. So he went to rehab and they stuck together through that, and thank God, because it was the band's third number one album in the UK. It reached number 3 on Billboard 200. And yeah, it was just a beautiful, just beautiful piece of work. Grammys, albums, awards, left and right. Yeah, it was just a really phenomenal show. The follow-up to that from Muse was The Second Law. And here is where it would have been really interesting to have Sean here, because Sean and I have very different opinions on The Second Law. It feels slightly longer than other Muse albums, or at least other recent Muse albums, but it's really not. It's 13 songs, 53 minutes long, so it doesn't even crack an hour yet, and still absolutely acceptable. However, Muse released this album in 2012 on the cusp of when electronic music stopped being like an afterthought in rock and alternative, and kind of just dance music that was still not hitting its big cross from dance music or electronic music into what we now know as the EDM kind of firebrand. But it's right here. early 10s, so 2012 is actually when Second Law gets released. So 2011 when they're making it, and 2010 definitely when they're conceptualizing it. And they want to keep their rock kind of vibe and sound, but they want to evolve into electronics a little bit. And the Second Law, I feel like they couldn't really make up their mind. And so they did a little bit of both. And sometimes that went well, and then other times it just kind of became forgettable. At least is in my opinion. Sean has a different opinion, and I'm not going to do it justice right now, but we'll definitely do it justice when Sean gets to come back and talk about simulation theory and give his kind of muse reviews. Nevertheless, from the Second Law, I love two very different songs, and they're both in the beginning. Madness, I really enjoy because it's muses all in going into electronic music, and it's very synthesizer heavy. There's very light elements of guitar. It's mostly just like an electronic synthesizer song, while trying to maintain almost like a rock ballad kind of sound. Nevertheless, it sounds really pleasing to me, and it's the most relaxing, kind of groovy, honestly sensual, like, muse song of many relaxing, groovy, sensual muse songs. I actually forgot to mention Undisclosed Desires in the Resistance album. Secretly one of my favorite songs, like, ever. It's just such a... gives me chills. And I can play it on bass, too, so you have that to look forward to if you ever are unlucky enough to know me in real life. Anyways, you know it's a really dark time when you're about 19 minutes into a podcast by yourself. But nevertheless, I appreciate you for listening. Yeah, Sean liked a little bit more of this album and saw a little bit more of what it was doing than I did. I saw it honestly most as a flop and really disappointing coming after The Resistance, although I'm not sure that that's the problem when you release an album that's just like too good and too critically acclaimed and kind of honestly overplayed. You can release an album 3 years later, which is a perfectly good amount of time to rethink your sound, but that's such a risk, and not everyone does it really well. I mean, people are still arguing whether or not Arctic Monkeys' Tranquility Base Hotel and Casino was a worthy successor to AM. And, you know, Sean and I had that conversation on previous episodes of Audio Face, both the Arctic Monkeys Primer episode and the review of Tranquility Base, and we'll definitely be talking about that in our wrap-up Audio Face Awards a lot. But it's really hard to follow up what is critically acclaimed and by fans acclaimed as like one of your best albums ever, and you follow that up with something and you're trying to experiment and be different and reinvent the wheel. But even even very talented bands don't do that totally well, and I don't think they did that really well completely. I think Muse fell into the concept too much, and I'm not even sure they, I don't know if they decided on a concept enough to really kind of stick to it in order to make the Second Law feel like a cohesive work. But on the flip side, Panic Station was a very, really fun, rocky song. It felt like a callback to old Muse while keeping things kind of new. And if the album sounded a little bit closer to Panic Station, I mean, I don't know, it probably would have been a step backward a little bit from The Resistance, but at times The Resistance kind of felt overwhelming and all over the place, that would have been fine. It would have been more in the Supermassive Black Hole direction, but really, Panic Station was like the updated Supermassive Black Hole song that's really good. It's nice to have just a Muse power rock ballad fun type of album where you're just letting out energy and having fun, because that's just like the classic Muse type of song. Drones. Drones was the next Muse album. Came out in 2015. And that's really the most recent Muse album we have to go off of, other than Simulation Theory. It was recorded in Up Down to the Wire in 2014, 2015, and released in mid-2015 as a concept album. And here's one thing I need to mention about Muse really fast, is that something that kind of bothers me with Muse, and this is a unique thing, because of course I work in news media and I work around politics all the time. That being said, I know when people can get too preachy when it comes to politics, and I don't want to tell people to, hey, not just like, you know, stick to sports or whatever, or not talk about politics. But I think there are ways you can do it without being so ham-fisted or being sort of like, just kind of going overboard and being overbearing with the political message you're trying to have. And Muse, I felt, has never really gotten that mix properly. All of its earlier kind of political undertones, back when it was going to the thematics about, just the thematics about dystopian governments and kind of world ending, it seemed a little bit more grounded because there was talking about societal things and those felt a little more, at least it wasn't ham-fisted, that approach. Drones is a lot ham-fisted. It takes the concept of you being a soldier, or a quote-unquote human drone, who is tasked by a government or sort of brainwashed by a government to kill unnecessarily and randomly and without a lot of thought going into it. And this album kind of goes through your journey of being abandoned to being accepted and brought part of this army, I guess, of human-killing drones, and then defecting. And it's a relation... The idea of drones is not like the predator drones of Obama. It's more just like a robot that is controlled by a bigger power. And that's very apparent in the album cover. It's a person controlling a joystick, watching a TV where other people are marching. And that person themselves has a head that is a joystick that's being controlled by what looks like a politician's hand, or at least someone in a suit and tie who has the ability to call nukes. It's very deep. It's hyper woke. A lot of people really liked it. I say I liked it a little bit more than Second Law, but it was just so overbearing with the politics. And don't get me wrong, this is politics I largely agree with. I'm largely against the American government's use of predator drones in unwarranted killings where they don't investigate who they're dropping bombs on enough. And so I don't want to get too much into politics, especially because I've been rambling on for 30 minutes and that's a lot to begin with. But if you are making this kind of album, it's just gonna come off as very ham-fisted, and you have to be really, like, you have to be a telesaur watching, like, RT intravural drip, like, through your veins in order to really love this whole album and listen to it all and not just kind of get exhausted by the message. Like, we get it, you kill indiscriminately, we get it, you have no brain. Like, there's just not a lot of, I guess, range. And when you listen to an album, it's nice to have a little bit of mystery, I guess, or a little bit of mystique. This album is just so much hitting you over the head with its message that it does get distracting from the music itself. The music itself, pretty decent. I think it's one of the harder rock releases that Muse has made in a while. It brings up Absolution. Yeah, it definitely brings up Absolution a lot. Because it's just very loud and rocky. There were songs I definitely liked in it. I liked Psycho and Dead Inside. I think those are very, like, classic Musey songs. But yeah, the rest was just way too hitting me over the head with the political message, which I don't necessarily have a problem with. At least as far as whether I agree with it or not. So that's not the issue. It's just that it's getting in the way of the music, and that was my sort of problem with it. So that's kind of my rundown of Muse, and that was like my fast kind of feelings of all these songs and albums. As you can tell, I like a lot of earlier Muse a little bit more. I feel like the later two albums, Second Law and Drones, have been kind of a kind of slow decline from that peak glory. And I don't know. I still love Muse. I still think they've got an insane amount of talent. Just no band is willing to do the kind of stuff that Muse has done on, like, a consistent basis. And they're always trying to reinvent their sound. They're always trying to be a little bit different. They're staying true to who they are, but they're, like, also staying true to music and the art of it. And what you can really do with it when you sit down and put your mind to it and try to make something a little bit weird. And so I will always appreciate that spirit wherever I see it as much as possible, when other things kind of like aren't in the way, you know? But I gotta keep them honest. The last two records I feel like haven't been quite it for me. And I'm really hoping Simulation Theory is something that kind of changes that all for me. And if not, whatever. Sean has largely similar opinions to me, I will say, up into Black Holes and Revelations. Of course, as usual, he will have noticed things that I didn't notice or didn't totally think about. I don't know about his Muse background, at least as far as there, because I'm pretty sure we're in agreement. Around the Resistance and the Second Law and Drones, he starts to have varying opinions from me, but they're largely in the same place. But I'm not going to speak too much for him. You can listen to Sean's opinions on Simulation Theory as well as mine, and you can hear Sean's opinions on Muse and other stuff in the history in the next episode of Audio Face. That'll be episode 74. That'll be coming out later this weekend. Later this weekend. You will get it soon. Thank you for listening. If you're listening this far, then you're one of our devoted listeners. We really, really appreciate you. We do this for you. We lose sleep and do things that, how do I put this? We take time out of our lives, which are busy, but we enjoy this because we know you're out there and we know you listen to the end, and we really appreciate that stuff. But if you do, share the appreciation and show us that you appreciate back by making sure you follow us on social media at AudioFacePod, on Twitter and Instagram. I am on Twitter and Instagram. No, I'm on Instagram at Dan from the Internet, Twitter at Dan from the Web, and Sean is at SW Suarez on both. Sorry I'm tired, but it's talking for 30 minutes straight. Anyways, thank you for listening. We'll see you next episode. Cheers.